The pieces of material flutter in the Caneland wind. The knots are tied meticulously to the sugar cane, each slightly different from the next. A progression of fantasy, a delirious artwork, and each represents a life. Another knot is tied, another woman dies. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 159, The Serial Crimes of Sipho Tswala. Now it's time for my monthly tip about the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And from Monday the 29th of July, you can catch part two of the original production, Secrets of a Murder Detective, Season 1, as decorated detective Steve Keogh takes viewers behind the scenes at London's New Scotland Yard, giving his unique insights on a further 10 cases. Watch a brand new standalone episode Monday to Friday at 8 p.m. on DSTV Channel 170 and StarSat 222. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Fatiswa Jokazi, Isabella McKay, Carla, and Connie Weldeck for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. I was rather surprised when I realized I hadn't covered this case on the podcast yet. It came up while I was watching Catch Me a Killer on Showmax. There's a companion podcast series for that too, if you haven't listened to it, and you can have a look in the feed. I honestly thought I'd covered most of the 1990s serial killers, and Tswala's name and his moniker as the Cane Killer or the Phoenix Strangler was known to me. So I was taken aback to see that there was no episode on this case among the 159 episodes to date. As I'll discuss in the episode, I also think that this case presents a lot of the elements we've come to see South African serial killers represented as on television and fictional media. My sources for this episode include two books by Mickey Pistorius, Strangers on the Street and Catch Me a Killer, as well as a few online sources. So, let's get into episode 159, The Serial Crimes of Sipho Tswala.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
The first thing I must address before I even get into this case is that we don't have a single victim's name in this episode. Very few of the victims were identified due to the circumstances around the murders, but some eventually were. Unfortunately, not a single name was released to the public, as far as I could find. The crime scenes in today's case are located in the sugarcane fields of KwaZulu-Natal. The generally hot and humid province has not always been the biggest producer of sugar in the country. In fact, sugarcane was not indigenous to the area at all, but was brought here as a crop in 1848, and KZN soon proved to provide the most ideal climate for it. The cane fields have proven a sustainable and helpful contributor to the economy in that province, but even before the words serial killer were uttered, they had a pretty dark history. When the crop was brought to South Africa, the white settlers who were appointed as the owners of stretches of land in KZN on which the crop was to be grown sought labourers for the land. Historically, it's believed that the settlers had initially looked to the Zulu people of KZN to provide that labour. But the Zulu people refused to work settlers' land, and instead, the settlers turned to a system of indentured labourers from India. At the time, many Indian people were being crippled by debt or poverty due to the caste system which was in place in that country. This led to many desperate Indians from the north and south of India making their way on steamships to work in the sugarcane fields of South Africa. The so-called indentured labour system was not much better than slavery. Workers were contracted to a 5-year agreement where they worked in the fields from sunrise to sunset, and it was not uncommon for wages and rations to be withheld at the farm owner's whim. This indentured labour system led to the development of an Indian community within South Africa, as individuals would remain in the country even after completing their contracts, or they would have children who were born here and went on to live in South Africa. We, of course, now have a South African community of Indian descent, which forms part of our multicultural nation, and many South African Indians can trace their heritage back to these dark days of their desperate ancestors attempting to make a life for themselves in incredibly harsh and often inhumane conditions. There are several large and small sugarcane farms in KZN today, and one of those is a mixed development area originally called Kanubia Estate, which originated as a 1,200 square hectare sugarcane farm. The area is in Phoenix, and on the edge of this is a township called KwaMashu. It would be on the outskirts of KwaMashu in an informal settlement called Besta, which was perched on a hill overlooking the cane fields that a killer would sit and plan out his murders between 1996 and 1998. On the 17th of February 1997, the first victim in this series was discovered. As you'll come to understand, it's important to note that the order in which the victims were discovered is definitely not necessarily the order in which they were killed, as most of the victims were severely decomposed or their bodies were damaged by fire, determining exactly when they were killed was very difficult. These same factors meant that most of the victims would also not be identified, and this too played a role in it being difficult to say when which victim had died. When we know who a victim is, We can also find out when they were last seen alive, and thus, when they were likely killed. The first victim to be discovered was found in field 301 of the sugarcane farm. She was clothed in a dress, but her shoes were missing. Her hands were tied behind her back with a green cloth, and the level of decomposition of her body meant that it was impossible to ascertain whether she'd been raped. On the 13th of April 1997, another female victim was discovered, this time in field 431. Her top was pushed up, and she'd been strangled with panties which had been torn into strips. This victim's hands were not tied, and her skirt and shoes were missing. She was also significantly decomposed. As we start to get an indication of this offender's modus operandi and the signature elements of his crimes, we can also see how difficult it is to tell when which of the victims was killed. We know, of course, that serial killers' scenes are never identical, but many of the same basic elements of the fantasy are often present. These offenders do tend to change up small things along the way, though, as they figure out what exactly they prefer and what helps them achieve the greatest sense of power and control during the murders. So, for instance, this victim, who was discovered second, could have actually been killed before the victim who was found first, because the second victim's hands were not bound, but the first was. And as the series progresses, we'll see this offender's affinity for binding both the hands and feet of his victims. This certainly becomes more clear in the victims who were clearly killed later in the series. The following month, another victim was found. This victim's remains were already close to skeletonized. Her hands and feet were bound with strips of cloth, and her handbag and shoes were beside her body. Sugarcane is generally harvested at the driest time of the year, and in KwaZulu-Natal, June is generally the driest month. Before harvesting, farmers set controlled fires to burn through the fields to get rid of snakes and cane rats to make harvesting easier and safer. The burning of the fields that occurred during this time also revealed many more victims hidden in the fields. The offender would later claim that he'd purposefully chosen to leave his victims in the cane fields because he believed the burning would help to destroy evidence. On the 4th of June 1997, just after the first controlled fires had burned through some of the fields, the charred remains of a woman were found in field 243. The woman was on her stomach, and her hands were tied behind her back. It was difficult to tell whether she'd been naked before the fire, but she was wearing white tackies, which had, bizarrely, remained completely untouched by the fire. As harvesters entered field 673 5 days later, they discovered another body. This victim was also on her stomach and had a gag in her mouth, which was tied around her neck. The woman's torso had been pressed between cane stalks, which seemed to be a method the killer had been trying out to restrain his victims. While it's not entirely uncommon for murder victims to be left in the cane fields of KZN, this is usually a rare occurrence. But I can't imagine what the team working these fields in 1997 must have experienced as they started to realize that they were essentially harvesting in a killing field. And every day they arrived for work brought another chance that they may stumble upon some horrific scene. And on the 18th of June, it happened again. Yet another victim whose remains had been burned was discovered in field 671. The victim's hands were bound behind her back with plastic hessian, and her feet were also bound with this material. Inside her mouth was a wad of material made up of strips of panties. This was a new element, which would be seen in many of the other victims too. This victim was also gagged, and the gag was extended and wrapped around her neck. Strips of a T-shirt remained behind on the scene, discarded not far from the body. Just 2 days later, yet another victim was found in exactly the same field. This victim was on her stomach, with her hands tied behind her back with strips of petticoat, and her ankles bound with the same. This victim also had a gag in her mouth and around her neck, and her torso was pushed between the cane stalks. All seven of these cases had been reported to Phoenix SAPS, but they had all been allocated to different investigating officers. None of these first seven victims could be identified, which only made the investigation process even more difficult. Soon, though, one of the investigating officers realized that something was very wrong, and there was a good chance all of these murders were linked. Phoenix SAPS asked the Durban Murder and Robbery Unit to assign an investigator who'd been trained in serial murder investigations. At the time, profiler Mickey Pistorius was training as many detectives as she could in the investigation of serial murder. Superintendent Philip Veldhuizen had been on Pistorius's course, and he was put in charge of these seven cases at that time. He formed a task team, including another serial-trained detective, Alan Alford, and they brought in two of the Phoenix-based detectives. This would be beneficial, as the detectives would have local knowledge, and also working on an investigation like this would help them to build a skill set for future serial murders in their area. An operations room was set up, and Mickey Pistorius was asked to travel to KwaZulu-Natal from Pretoria. Pistorius would put together a profile of the killer, which, once he was arrested, would prove to be incredibly accurate. On the 12th of July 1997, another body was discovered, this time in field 462. The victim's hands were tied behind her back, and her feet were bound with torn pieces of panties, which also formed the gag in her mouth and wrapped around her neck. The body was decomposed and had clearly been there before the task force was formed, and so Veldhuizen decided that it would be vital to have dogs trained in the scent detection of cadavers to scour the fields. They needed to know exactly how many victims they were actually dealing with, and they needed to find victims sooner to help retrieve any possible DNA samples. By this point, it was difficult to prove whether any of the victims had been raped, and impossible to get a semen sample due to the level of decomposition. If they could use the dogs to find the bodies in the huge area, it might help to catch the killer before he killed again. As the trained canine officers arrived at the scene, several more bodies were discovered in quick succession. On the 23rd of July, a female victim was found in field 461. She was lying on her side with her hands and feet tied with Hessian rope. She was gagged with strips of petticoat, and torn strips of a bra were found at the scene. Another victim was found by the dogs on the same day in field 434. Her hands were tied with strips of petticoat too, and there was also a wad of the same material in her mouth. She had been gagged and strangled with a piece of that petticoat. Panties had been placed over her head, but her feet were not tied. The following day, the dogs found another body in field 461. The woman's body was badly decomposed. She was fully clothed and laying on her back with her hands tied in front of her. A wad of petticoat material was in her mouth, and her feet were tied together with a strip of dress fabric. Later that same day, another decomposed body was discovered. The woman was lying on her back, and her legs were tied with a piece of petticoat. She had been gagged and strangled with the petticoat material too. Her panties had been torn off her body and lay around her ankles in tatters. The dogs then led their handlers to field 434, where another victim was discovered, with her legs and hands tied with strips of bra as well as floral material. She had been gagged with the floral material too, and a bra strap had been tied in a knot on the top of her head. In that very same field, as the dogs alerted to one body, police discovered another. This victim's feet were tied with strips of panties and a scarf. Her hands were not tied, and there was no gag on this victim. Finally, later that same day, yet another victim was discovered in field 434. The victim was dressed only in a petticoat, and her hands were tied with a black scarf. Strips of the scarf had been torn off and were used to bind her feet. She had been strangled with a bra strap, and panties had been thrown on top of her body. The less decomposed bodies would reveal the likely cause of death of all of the victims: strangulation. Post-mortem examinations would show, though, that many of the victims had sustained blunt force injuries to their face or heads. While these injuries wouldn't have been significant enough to kill them, they would likely have been knocked unconscious. It seemed that the killer was blindsiding his victims with a blow and then restraining them while they were unconscious or impaired, and finally strangling them either before or after he'd raped them. The woman who would become the final victim in the series was found on the 5th of August. She was naked except for a blue jersey. She had been strangled to death with a pair of red panties, but there was no gag, and her hands and feet were not tied. On the cane stalks around the scene, pieces of fabric were tied and fluttered in the wind. Three condoms were found on the scene. Now, when I discovered that it would be DNA that would end up solving this case and identifying the perpetrator, I figured that it had been these three condoms which had contained the offender's DNA. But in one article I read, one of the investigating officers on the case said that the DNA samples had actually been obtained from chewed up pieces of sugarcane that were found at the scene. Either way, the DNA match would come later. This was 1997, and there was no database to run the sample against anyway. For the DNA to be useful to investigators, they needed to identify a suspect to compare the DNA with. With 16 murder victims, Valthason asked Phoenix police to scour the case records further back and find anything even remotely similar, even if they were rapes without murders or if the victims had survived. And with that inclusion, he struck gold. In April 1996, almost a year before the first body was discovered in the cane fields, a woman had opened a case of rape and attempted murder at Phoenix Police Station. Her testimony contained some very similar elements to the murders, including the binding of the victim. The woman, who cannot be identified and is referred to as Ms. M in Mickey Pistorius's book Strangers on the Street, was able to tell police the name of her assailant at the time. She said his name was Sipho Tswala. Tswala had been arrested in 1996, and his DNA had been taken. He'd been charged with rape and attempted murder, but when it came time for the trial, Miss M had not arrived, and the trial could not proceed. The charges had been dropped, and Sipho Tswala had been released. Fast forward to August 1997, Veldhuizen was convinced that this was his man, and while he sent in a request for Twala's DNA sample to be compared to the DNA found on the murder scene, he put the wheels in motion to track the man down. So as not to spook the man, once police had narrowed down the general area where they believed Twala lived, they didn't go in themselves. Instead, they hired trusted informants within the community to scout the area and figure out exactly where Twala was living. By 11 a.m. on the 13th of August, the call came in. Twala had been located. Over the next 12 hours, Veldhuizen planned a foolproof takedown of the presumed serial killer. Phoenix police explained that they would need to take the internal stability unit with them, as the community may well turn on the police when they arrived to arrest Twala, or they may turn on Twala and his family. In addition to this, Veldhuizen also wanted to ensure everyone was well rested before the arrest happened. Once they took Twala into custody, the next few hours of interviewing him would be golden, and if done right, could result in a confession, so everyone needed to be on their game. By 3 p.m. on the 14th of August, the task force assembled and moved into the Besta informal settlement on the fringes of Kwamashu. The internal stability unit surrounded the area, on alert for any acts of retribution from the community. The arrest itself went seamlessly. Veldhuizen knocked on the door to the home informants had identified as belonging to Sipho Twala, and he opened it. When asked, he identified himself and was immediately arrested. In handcuffs and leg shackles, a stunned Twala was given a seat in his home while police officers searched the house. While most of the home, which Sipho shared with his mother and some of her children, was entirely normal, the room, which was identified as being his bedroom, was a bizarre collection of pieces of women's clothing. They hung from the rafters and were stacked in piles in the corner. Beside his bed, there was a stack of women's watches. The room was photographed and the items collected as evidence. Several pieces of clothing had been torn, and outside the home, police found an area of sugarcane stalks with pieces of material from the clothing tied to them in different knot styles. Twala would later confess that he'd practiced his knot-tying skills there while he looked out over the cane fields, thinking about his victims, who had remained undiscovered there at the time. Police also found several pieces of material folded into the type of wads that had been found in some of the victims' mouths. It would emerge that this fabric wad making had become part of Twala's fantasy building process between murders. He would make the wads and test them for size in his own mouth. Then, when he was satisfied that the wad was the perfect size to fill the mouth of his victim and silence her, he would place it in his pocket and walk around with it for several days. Just the knowledge that the wad was there, ready and waiting for his next victim, was enough to excite him. Twala's mother and other family members were understandably horrified that he was being arrested for such terrible crimes. They said that he had given them a few items of clothing, which they handed over to police, but for the most part said he was just extremely aggressive if they tried to touch anything in his bedroom. His family admitted that they were scared of him and tiptoed around him and his outbursts on a daily basis. As news spread through the community, crowds began to gather, and police were on high alert. They whisked away Twala's family for their own safety and transported Twala to Phoenix Police Station for questioning. Despite the crowd gathering, there was no violence. And instead, as the community members realized that the man who had killed so many women had been captured, they erupted into applause. This sense of joviality and peace did not last very long, though. And after Twala's family had returned home, a false rumor was spread that Sipho had come back with them, and the crowds descended on the family home. Twala's family had to flee and were eventually shepherded away by police as their home was burned to the ground. Thankfully, all of the required evidence had already been collected from Sipho's room, but that made little difference to his now homeless and ostracized family. The day after Twala was arrested, another body was discovered in the cane fields. For a fleeting moment, the investigation team were concerned that they may not have the man responsible for all of the murders in custody. Soon, though, they realized it was nothing more than a copycat. The offender, who had killed his girlfriend, had decided that by disposing of her body in the cane fields, he could escape justice and have her murder blamed on Twala. But he hadn't known about all the binding aspects of Twala's MO, because police had purposefully not released that information to the media, so it was very clear to police that this was not one of Twala's victims, and the real killer was soon identified and arrested. Sipho Twala was taken to the district surgeon to ensure that any injuries on his body were documented. It's not uncommon for suspects to claim that they've been beaten by police, so documenting their state of health upon arrest and before they're taken in for questioning is vital. Twala, though, needed little prompting to confess, and within hours he was telling police about how he had approached women on the streets where taxis often dropped them off. Using a common MO for South African serial killers, he claimed to be working for hotels in the area and trying to find cleaners to be hired at these venues. Understandably, the women jumped at the opportunities, and Twala would then tell them to follow him. If they questioned why they were walking through the cane fields and not sticking to the road, he would tell the woman he knew a shortcut, and they needed to get to the hotel quickly before someone else took the position. When he felt he was far enough away from other people, he would turn on the women, often striking them from behind, either with his fist or a rock if there was one within reach. Sipho Twala claimed that his hatred for women had been sparked by a girlfriend who had terminated a pregnancy with his child and then broken up with him. The woman's rejection, he claimed, was too much for him, and he'd begun to lash out at other women as a result. During the confession, he had used the interpreter as a model to show Walthuizen how he'd restrained his victims. There was little in Twala's background that pointed to him having had the capability to become such a vicious and prolific killer. Coming from an incredibly poverty-stricken background, Twala's birth had not been properly recorded, and he didn't actually know how old he was. He estimated that he was between 30 and 40 years old. He had only attended school to grade 2 level and had never been in formal employment. He'd been in prison once before for car theft and claimed to have been trained in the ANC's military wing, Mkhonto Wesizwe. He made a living by stealing sugarcane and selling it. The profile that Mickey Pistorius had put together matched Sipho Twala almost exactly. The only difference was that she'd anticipated the offender would have a secondary school education level. She felt that the elements of bondage involved in Twala's crimes spoke to his fear of intimacy. He didn't want women to be able to touch or speak to him, and so he bound and gagged them. In addition, the power and control he would have experienced with his victims being completely at his mercy would also have been a major part of his fantasy. Twala also acknowledged what police had started to suspect after finding strips of material at scenes that seemed to not match what that victim was wearing. He was keeping items of clothing from previous victims to tear into strips and use as binds, gags, and mouthwads for future victims. By doing this, whether he consciously understood this or not, he would have been crossing over the rush he'd felt at previous murders with the murder he was committing at the time. He was linking his victims together, making one unintentionally the undoing of the next. The trial of Sipho Twala started in 1999. Police had been searching for Miss M, Twala's first rape and attempted murder victim, from when they'd found out about her case at the DNA match stage. They were deeply concerned that Twala may have killed the woman to silence her, but finally, just days before the trial was due to start, with the help of local media outlets, they were able to locate her, and she agreed to testify at trial. The woman, who had been able to survive Twala's first attempt at murder, would now be the voice for the 16 women who had lost their lives to him. Twala, represented by advocate Kenneth Samuels, was charged with the rape and attempted murder of Miss M, as well as an additional 16 rapes and 16 murders. Although prosecutor Gary Williams didn't have physical evidence of rape in many of the cases, as the women were too decomposed for such evidence to be found, the team felt that they could show that Twala's MO had always included rape, and therefore it would be fair to conclude that all the victims had been raped. This idea goes along the lines of what we now call similar fact evidence, a common form of evidence presented by experts in serial offender trials to show that modus operandi and geographical aspects of a series of crimes can link the cases to one another, and then prosecutor links at least some of those cases directly to the suspect in question through other evidence. Similar fact evidence would only first be used successfully in 2006, though, in the case against the Quarry serial killer, Richard Nyauza. In the case against Sipho Twala, the judge would find him guilty of the rape and attempted murder of Ms. M, as well as the rape of the last two victims, where condoms were found at the scenes and their bodies were less decomposed. In seven of the cases, the judge found that the state of undress in which the bodies were found suggested, at the very least, indecent assault, and he found Twala guilty of that charge instead. But in the remaining seven cases, he felt he had to acquit Twala of the rape charges, as there was simply not enough evidence to prove he had definitely raped those victims. As for the murder charges, though, Twala was found guilty of all 16 murders. His sentencing was quite complex, as sentences often were at that time, and he was given 30 years per murder, plus additional time for the other crimes. But the judge handed down the sentences in combinations of consecutive and concurrent, so his total determinate sentence seemed to equate to 506 years. I say seemed because I've learned to be hesitant to accept anyone's interpretation of sentences without seeing the sentencing document myself firsthand, and I haven't seen it here. So while we can't say for 100% sure what the sentence really meant, suffice to say, it was a very, very long time. As is quite common with serial offenders, Twala did not apologize for his crimes, and he did not show any remorse. Twala's mother described her son as an intelligent man who could read and write well, even though he'd never received schooling beyond grade 2. Quote, "He was a normal child. a gentleman and helpful around the house. He also brought us groceries when he had money. We are relieved he's been sent to jail. Who knows, he may have turned against us one day. End quote. Although many KZN serial killers and other murderers have used the cane fields as their killing grounds, for me, Tswala's crimes have seemed to most prominently influence some of the fictional depictions around South African serial killers we've seen in popular media. I think it's the imagery of the crimes, perhaps, that captures the creative mind. The vastness of a sugarcane field, its stark beauty, the solitude that hides in the confines of the plants growing side by side, and that, contrasted by the horror of a slain victim. A woman whose hope for a lifeline of employment leads her into the most desperate of struggles for life. The image of a man whose mind has been taken over by an overwrought search for revenge, standing on a hill, overlooking those fields, methodically tearing strips of cloth from his victim's clothes. As he does, remembering their last moments, the lives he took. And then, slowly, deliberately, practicing the knots that would eke the breath from future victims' lungs, steal their freedom, and bind their lives. These are powerful images. I'm not surprised we see them so often in fictional portrayals. What easier way to contrast what we think good and evil is than to put death against nature and gore against beauty? But that's fiction. And this is real life. In real life, the horror didn't end in the sugarcane fields. In real life, 16 families lost their loved ones, and most still have no idea what happened to them. In real life, there are parents out there who still wonder where their daughters went, who hope that they're living happy lives somewhere, but feel deeply that something very bad occurred. In real life, there are children who grew up wondering about the mother they thought left them 27 years ago. The mother who went out to look for work one day and never came home. And they've wondered why she abandoned them, why they weren't loved, when the truth is that she didn't leave. Not willingly. Not in the way her family thinks she might have. But that doesn't ease the pain, because who would ever think that this could be their story? These 16 unidentified victims of this offender, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.